So welcome again. And I have two alternate titles for tonight's talk that I couldn't decide between. So you can choose. The first one is, what are you learning right now in practice? What are you learning? And the second is sensitivity, surrender, and softening self-view. So you can choose the simple koan or the more detailed. But we'll go into all those themes. And some of this arose out of interaction I've been having a lot with people. I have an almost 2-year-old son. And whenever I see people, they ask, well, how's he doing? And then they ask, usually the next question, one of the next questions is, well, what is he learning right now? What's he learning? And it is this astonishing time of exponential developmental growth in terms of learning about himself and the world. But what's arisen for me lately when I'm hearing this question is this curiosity about, well, what are you learning? Not so much about the material world and how to turn over and where my hand is in relation to my body and all of that, but in your practice and about your mind, like what is it that you're learning this particular time? So it's been an interesting exploration for me. So there are going to be a lot of child-rearing examples tonight, and I have to just apologize at the outset. It's just my world right now. So hopefully you'll be able to relate whether or not you have children. And a lot of it is just learning how to relate also to our own minds. You know, you're relating to this being, but you're also learning how to relate to your mind. So I'm hoping that this, you'll find it relevant. So I was reading a blog, and there was a link to a YouTube video on this blog. It was around Easter time, and it was of an Easter egg hunt with children ages 3 to 5, and set up in a beautiful setting. They all had their baskets. The parents were told specifically to wait behind this line, this kind of barrier. Please wait and just let the children go explore Easter egg hunt. So they said, okay, let's begin. Maybe some of you actually saw this. And within about 5 seconds, the parents had taken over the barrier, rushed through it, and were guiding, sort of in a manic way, their children to try to find the eggs, to like showing them where they were hidden, here it's over here. And the camera was on this one little boy with a basket, was kind of wandering around in circles, just overridden by this kind of stampede is too strong a word, but by this tide of parents who were directing the show. And one of the titles of the video was When Parents Invade Childhood. But my first thought in seeing it is, oh, this is when clinging overtakes discovery. That's what this looks like. When clinging overtakes discovery. The joy of exploring and finding something that might not be immediately obvious. So you could feel, and this isn't to be judgmental of the parents, they were wanting the best for their children, they were wanting a good experience for their children, but so much of our lives and how we're conditioned is around performance, it's around succeeding, and it's definitely around getting. And how clearly this just overtakes any kind of natural joy of discovery often. And it can happen in our spiritual practice as well. We can approach it, if we're not careful, at times like a bit of an Easter egg hunt. For, you know, in some way or another, seeking maybe special states, seeking a better self-image, even seeking to end myself as some kind of reward or prize at the end. So what's the, you know, Utejaniya was here a few weeks ago, the Burmese master, and often is just asking, what's the attitude in my mind right now? Am I rushing the gate and trying to get something? What's the attitude in my mind? And I think one of the most helpful attitudes that we can bring to practice and to just about everything, along with care and goodwill, basic goodwill, is this natural curiosity and exploration. So how can we approach practice this way? Less of a contest, less of a performance that we need to succeed at, and more discovery. So Rodney, last week, introduced this new series that he's beginning using the framework of these different continua, the plural of continuum, I learned. So using suffering to the end of suffering as a basic guideline, but also moving from being unconscious to conscious, moving from contraction to love. And in all of these continua, however we're relating to that, it's dependent upon a deepening of wisdom, however we're moving, dependent on learning, on discovering something new. And this kind of mechanism for discovery is a sensitivity. Feels like a natural sensitivity of heart, which you can see obviously in children who are constantly experimenting with their senses. One teacher calls this toddler phase like the mad scientist phase. They're just trying to figure out how everything works. Like, what happens if I hit something? What happens if I lick it or swallow it? And so this kind of natural discovery helps move us along each of these continua. And we can definitely learn through suffering, but I think increasingly we can also learn through play and through experimentation and through, really, I'll talk about this more at the end, but playing at the edge of wherever we perceive a natural boundary or limit. Oh, how pliable is this? How can I stretch this? So in contrast to the Easter egg model, I was listening to a podcast and it told this story. They were telling the story of this man. I shared this on retreat. Some of you may have heard this already. But they were telling the story of this man named Daniel Kish, who was blind from about the age of 18 months. And it's this remarkable story in which his mother made a conscious choice at some point or other to not base her parenting style or her relationship to him based on fear. That there was all this, when he went blind, all the people around him immediately became fearful that he was going to hurt himself. So a grandmother said, well, why don't you just wrap him up in cotton so he's completely protected, so he'll never get injured. And she at some point, it's hard to even conceive of how she did this, but just said, no, I'm gonna let him just explore however he wants. So she let him climb trees. She let him learn to ride a bike. She let him, start making lunch for himself and develop all of these skills because he was naturally curious. And so what he naturally started to do was echolocate. Was click his tongue, like many underwater mammals do, to try to sense where he was in space and navigate. And because this was never checked, so because his mother encouraged it and allowed this, by the time he was a teenager, he was almost completely self-sufficient. And so at this point, as an adult, he's in his 40s, he can mountain bike, he can lead hikes, He can do almost anything that a sighted person can do. And this is where I think it's relevant for our practice. He said that what allowed him to do this is that he never had the concept of himself as a blind person. He never had the self-view or the self-definition of himself as a blind person. That he was always free to explore and investigate and navigate the world as he wanted to. And of course, along the way, there were plenty of bumps and scrapes, and you know, he knocked out most of his teeth. And this was not a pain-free process. But in contrast to the way that other blind people were raised at that time, which was with a concept of what a blind person can do and not do. This is safe, this isn't safe, a blind person can't hold a job, they can't navigate through traffic. So he was able to develop this remarkable sensitivity and a way of being in the world that relied on a completely different sense. And so now his life's work is helping other young children who've been raised kind of with the other model of being very, very protected and sheltered and having everything done for them so they can't explore. Helping them gradually work out of their comfort zone so they feel free to take risks and see what they're capable of. So I've been very inspired by this as a model because it's so easy to be governed by fear and to be governed by a self-concept. You know, where our self-view forms very early on in relationship to other people, and we internalize this definition of who we are, the kind of person we are, what we're capable of and what we aren't. And this blocks a lot of our innate sensitivity and exploration. So if we think about that for a moment, like, is it possible that there's so much more here than I've previously been aware of? That when I can let that self-definition and living through concept and thought, when I can let that navigation system soften a bit, there may be a whole nother realm of sensitivity, of intimacy with our surroundings, and of moving through life. It's a very different perceptual system that takes a lot of experimentation, a lot of feedback, and a lot of probably getting scraped up sometimes. From moving through without our habitual defenses in that way. So I want to talk a little bit about this process of becoming sensitive. It feels like a process that we move through. And maybe taking off some of those layers of cotton that we're inadvertently covered in. And one of my teachers always often offers this contemplation, Gregory Kramer, just reflecting on the amazing sensitivity of listening right now at this particular moment, of the vibration of my voice coming out of my mouth and actually vibrating the bones in your ear as you're listening. So air coming up, the voice coming out, and it vibrating, the sounds in your ear. And somehow you have all of your associations and concepts that help you recognize what I'm saying and interpret what I'm saying, but just that level of sensitivity that we walk through the world with is extraordinary. And is it possible that our perceptions of who we are and what we're capable of are just a bit too narrow for that sensitivity? So when we start to bring awareness to our experience, both internal and external, we become more attuned to that sensitivity. So it's not that we're ever not sensitive. We're constantly being affected by things. That's the nature of the heart and mind. It's constantly receiving impressions, constantly responding to the environment. But when we start to practice awareness, we bring our attention directly to that natural sensitivity, and it heightens. We become more used to living from that place, and it also heightens. So you notice that to some degree, once you start paying attention to the body wakes up. It enlivens. Like, oh, it's actually alive in here. There's life in here. It's not just a conceptual, dry, sterile field. So we start to notice this. Larry Rosenberg says, there is only this living, breathing body and the knowing of it. This living, breathing body and the knowing of it. So we would start to become more sensitive, of course, to dukkha. This is kind of our primary instruction, especially on the suffering to end of suffering continuum. We really begin to get a feel of what is this experience of unsatisfactoriness, unpleasantness, disappointment, disease, of this body kind of eventually losing its faculties, of fading, of getting sick, of not getting what it wants. So we become very sensitized to that and the state of our own mind and heart in response to that. So what is that interplay of what the body is taking in and how the mind and heart are responding? But isn't it astonishing to be able to know that we know? And is it possible to keep just a little bit of that astonishment and wonder? That we can actually know what the state of our own heart and mind is and reflect on that and really feel what that is. To be confused, to be perplexed, to be grief-stricken, to be disappointed, to be elated. We can actually know that directly. So we start to become sensitive to this. And I think equally importantly, how our own attitude of mind, our own mind state affects other people. So this interpersonal exchange, how it affects other people. So I talked about the mad scientist toddler just blindly trying to figure out how things work. But over time, we really begin to sense our impact on others. How the way that we're relating to ourselves is impacting other people. So again, I'm learning a lot from parenting, but was reading one blog that talked about the best thing that we can teach our children and relate to our own minds is this phenomenon of natural consequences. So as they're learning and as we're learning, it can be tempting to bring an evaluation to everything. Oh, you climbed up on the couch, good job. Oh, you read that story, good job. You're such a good reader, you're such a good runner, you're such a good meditator. It can be so tempting to really have our whole world governed by evaluation, by praise and blame. And what's much more effective is to affirm reality. Oh, you got up on the couch by yourself. That must feel good. It looks like you feel good about that. You're able to read that story. And so we can, with our own practice as well, just pare down to the facts of what's actually happening. I'm sitting here. They didn't say what I wanted them to say. There's boredom. There's tiredness. Not, I'm a good meditator. I'm a bad meditator. I could have done better. It's just the very simple noticing of the direct present moment experience. And then the natural consequences piece is realizing how we're interacting with the world from that place. So when I speak in anger, it has this effect. With toddlers, when I hit someone, they cry. Look at that. It hurts. When I bite someone, there's pain. But it's not so different with us as we start to learn. As we start to learn with cause and effect. This is a sensitivity to what causes and conditions allow something to come into being and our responsibility and participation in that process. So kind of natural consequences. So in Buddhism, there are two terms that talk about this, and they're sometimes called the guardians of the world, because they refer to a kind of ethical sense or a sensitivity to our impact on others. And their hiri is one, and otapa is the next, and they're often talked about together. So I like the translation of conscience and concern. Sometimes, a bit dramatically, they're translated as moral shame and dread. And I don't think those are quite as helpful for our Western psyches. But conscience and concern. So the natural sort of hesitation that we feel or pause when we're about to do something that we know may have a difficult impact for someone. That natural, about to say something harmful, about to do something that's going to have an impact. That natural, like a natural pause. This, I think, deepens. Our sensitivity to this really deepens as we practice. And and the ability to reflect back and see where we have caused harm, where our actions have created a negative impact, and take responsibility for that. So it's quite different from guilt. So that's a good distinction, I think, always to make with Hiri and Otapa, is that guilt creates a bad self that's done something wrong and needs sort of repentance, needs to chew over it again and again and again. Oh, this was terrible. I shouldn't have done that. How am I going to make it better? And I think this natural conscience just sees where we've been unskillful and says, let me try to see if there's a different way next time. Let me see if there's a different way. So sensing, really sensing our impact, and more being governed by not wanting to cause harm. So this isn't paralysis. This isn't being afraid of taking one step or doing anything that might offend or cause harm, but this is really knowing what it is that we're responsible for and what we aren't, kind of ethical compass. I was once having a lot of doubt about an action or a decision that I had to make in my life, and I kept labeling it as doubt because I couldn't sense what the right thing to do was in the situation. I felt like I was going back and forth in a kind of unproductive place. And one teacher who I had an interview with said, I see that the doubt is present, but have you considered that sometimes healthy caution is a good thing? Sometimes it's a very good thing. What can feel to us as like spontaneous, authentic expression is sometimes reactivity. It's sometimes just our habitual acting out. So this kind of healthy caution that's aware of our impact. So what's crucial in all of this is that we can't learn, and in this process of becoming more sensitive and exploring, we can't learn if we're ruled by fear. Right? If you reflect on the times that you've felt like you were learning the most about yourself, about your experience, about your mind, if you're completely overtaken by fear, we're not in investigative or exploratory mode. And so if we look at some of our core fears and what keeps us from this kind of relationship, it's a fear generally not just of our physical death, but it's more of a death of that self-definition or self-identity that I talked about. So sometimes just called ego death. So most of us can identify more with a fear of the rejection, failure, not living up to some ideal. Sometimes that seems almost more real than the demise of the body. So Ajahn Amaro is one of the abbots at Amaravati Monastery in England. He writes in a book, Small Boat, Small Mountain, he talks about this, working with fear in his own practice. And he reflects on his own teacher, Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai meditation master in the Thai forest tradition. And for him, for Ajahn Chah, the biggest fear was of the demise of the body. That was what he could relate to most strongly. So for him, facing that was going to spend all night in the charnel grounds and being present when physical bodies were being cremated. And this brought up this extreme existential dread. So for him, facing this fear was this process, and he tells a wonderful story in this book about how he moves through this process and eventually realizes at the end of that the fear no longer has that hold over him, that he's not the body. But Ajahn Amaro was reflecting that in his own practice, what he could relate to even more than that was the fear of failure. He was so in this success-failure paradigm that to fail felt much more immediate and present for him and was getting in his way. So he undertook this as a practice, as his sort of charnel ground meditation, to try to fail as much as possible. He made a practice out of it. Can I move into those areas where I know I won't necessarily be great, where I won't get the approval that keeps my self-definition firmly in place? Can I risk failure and really get familiar with how that feels? And he said at first it was an experience of being shattered, feeling shattered over and over again. And the more he did it, he began to actually relish that feeling that would come up when he was about to fail. That there was this very productive feeling that he could work with, that became more play rather than survival. So this is moving from survival mode to exploratory mode. So we're constantly receiving feedback from the outside world, especially as we become more sensitive. It's this constant experience of receiving feedback. Sometimes in a very kind of overt and concrete way of receiving this kind of negative feedback that might imply that we're failing. But we might undertake as a practice, what is my relationship to feedback, to receiving feedback from the world, from other people, from life? We did a whole section on this at my last teacher training, and one of our fellow teacher trainees came up with a wonderful analogy that I've heard to use a bit in my own practice. And he describe this analogy of an echocardiogram. I don't know if any of you have had a stress test to test the strength of your heart under pressure. So you walk on a treadmill or you do something that gets the heart rate up, and it shows, because it's subjected to a little bit of pressure, it shows where the blockages are. It shows where things are continuing to get impaired, areas that you might want to look at. And this fellow teacher, Matthew Brensilver, talked about receiving feedback as a kind of stress test or echocardiogram for our sense of self-clinging, which I really liked. So giving a sense, wherever we receive feedback and there's some kind of sting, a lot of times our strategies to avoid it are quite elaborate. But when it actually does come our way, you know, solicited or unsolicited, to what extent does it sting? Does it seem to indicate something really true about me? Where am I really believing that self-definition, living by a self-concept? And can I explore that? Can I take that as an area that is really impeding the overall flow of my health and my well-being? And for some of us, receiving positive feedback is actually more difficult than negative. So the negative seems to somehow corroborate our self-image or how we think of ourselves. And to receive positive feedback seems more threatening somehow. Like, oh, this isn't how I perceive of myself. So we brush it off or we disregard it. We have a very hard time receiving it. So you might notice. Use that as your stress test. It doesn't at all mean that the feedback is absolutely right about you. Okay, the person may be wildly inaccurate in their interpretation. And that's fine. Wisdom can clearly, more and more clearly see what's accurate in a perception and what isn't, what's skillful and what isn't. But that the sting of it being a personal attack on me can start to lessen. So we can start to notice that. Because one, you know, this is actually one very important part of the learning process, is receiving feedback in some form. How do we learn otherwise? You know, it's taking a risk, it's moving forward, and then seeing what the result is, seeing what the outcome is, and receiving feedback, both from our own reflection and from others. So this is how learning happens. And in a community of spiritual friends, this is vitally important to our health and well-being, that we can help expand each other's perspective in this way, point some of these things out in an environment of care. You know, in the texts, for so many of the skillful qualities that we're inspired to cultivate, one of the causes for so many of these qualities to arise is associating with wise people. It's quite interesting and quite practical. So we obviously can't only associate with wise people, that would be limiting, but our spiritual community, our Dharma brothers and sisters are wonderful in being able to not only point out our blind spots, but to widen our perspective wherever we're getting locked in a self-concept or self-view that's limiting. So this is learning, this is how we learn from each other. So I know for me, many times this process of becoming more and more sensitive has felt very, very challenging. I've described it to many people as I feel like I'm walking around like a raw nerve, without my usual coping mechanisms, don't seem to be working in quite the same way, and feel a bit exposed and vulnerable. So it's not only about feeling sensitive. We are also, at the same time, developing the capacity to bear that, to be able to hold that in awareness and some kind of strength. So we're not just becoming more sensitive and only to be shattered. We need to have a strong stability, a strong support in order to do that. We have to increasingly be okay, feel our tolerance increase for being kind of disoriented and not knowing how to navigate. So I think of those kids who had been raised to think of themselves as blind children who couldn't do anything, and then all of a sudden are being asked to go climb a tree. How do I do this? How do I do this? But it's important. We have to do this if we're going to change the navigation system from just survival to learning, to exploratory. So this man, David Kish, said of his experience, running into a pole is a drag, but never being allowed to run into a pole is a disaster. So we start to shift the priority from safety at all costs and protection to relishing this learning. And again, our confidence and our capacity to be aware, the notion of what we actually take refuge in, is our refuge in awareness, in the teachings as we understand them, the process of nature as it's unfolding, and in our community. That's what can start to allow us to have the strength and patience to do this difficult work. So as we do this, we can feel the self-view start to soften. And like I mentioned, we can do this. We can, of course, always work with our sense of suffering and really notice and penetrate that. But I think we can also play with the self-view a bit. We can notice it and begin to kind of play with it, not take it quite as seriously, experiment and watch. Even in the course of the day, you can watch at some times yourself feeling very, very solid, very, very separate. When you're having some kind of a tantrum or a reactivity, feeling threatened in some way, feeling embarrassed, feeling targeted, sense of self becomes very, very solid. Feel very, very, this is me, this is my place, I need to defend it. And then as we relax, as we feel comfortable, as our circumstances change, it starts to get thinner. You can notice that, oh, that sense of a boundary is not quite there as much. We can just notice how there's an expansion and contraction throughout the day. It's very different. It's always shifting. So I just want to offer a few ways that we can soften and play with this self-view. Because this is the main thing that comes up, as I said, on the cardiac stress test. This blockage or clot. So we can notice how solid we feel when we have a need to be right. Noticing the need to be right. And these are just a few. I'll just offer a couple. Endless possibilities. But one of my mentors, Philip Moffat, calls this a renunciation practice. Can we renounce our need, so human and so reflexive, to be right, and feel that arise? That kind of the seductiveness of righteousness feels so alluring to be right. But in a way, this is blocking our capacity again to learn, to be aware, and increase in wisdom. So this is a clinging to a kind of view when we absolutely need, we need to be right. And for some of us, we have actually a greater need for others to be right. We can't so much identify our own view as valid, but we very much need someone else to be right for us. And things get very shaky when that starts to break apart. So noticing what this offers, and like Rodney often points to, what is the value of this and what is the limitation? So what does this offer me? How is this offering me a sense of really feeling here, feeling safe in whatever way? And how is this blocking my learning? How is this blocking me? So another way of softening our self-view is by creatively working with our habitual mind. One of the things that occurred to me this week, how easily we get into these grooves. And my husband is an avid cyclist, and he's been cycling since he was a teenager. And he has this set route that he rides to work every day. And he likes it, that's the way he goes. He leaves at the same time, he shows up at the same time, and this is just the way that he commutes to work, as many of us probably commute in some way or another. And he's never been in an accident or any kind of collision. And in the span of 1 week, 2 weeks ago, he was hit twice on his way to work. And he's fine, just bruised and no problem. But shaking up the kind of unexamined assumption that this route was safe and known. And he works in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. And so one of the people there, on his behalf, went to the Rinpoche, the head guru there, and said, Corin's been hit on his bike twice in a week. Like, what does this mean? And in that tradition, the guru it's a bit of a different relationship than in ours in terms of teacher and student. And the guru kind of just tells you how it is, tells you what it means, and you kind of go off and, you know, less dialogue. That's a gross generalization, but in this case, someone asked, "Well, you know, what does this mean? He's been hit twice in 1 week," and the Rinpoche said he needs to change his route. There was no deeper spiritual significance than that at all. It was just change your route. So this has become our mantra for the last few weeks. How can we change the route? Where am I getting in a groove that to me feels really safe and protected and familiar and so much like me? And how can I change it up? How can I change my route? Gandhi said, "My loyalty is to the truth the best I can discern it each day, not to consistency." Sometimes we have to change the direction that we think we're going. So another way that we can do this is to play. One way that the self-definition, self-concept, becomes very strong is when we identify with our roles, the roles that we play. So as mother, as student, as nurse, as healer, as daughter, as wife, the roles that we play, as creative one, reliable one, the rock, the responsible one, the artist, the spontaneous one. Like the story that I shared in the beginning, it's so easy for our world to become prescribed within that definition and to never venture out of it. Never test out of that. Because there's a point at which we need these roles to some degree. They allow us to perform a function. They allow us to relate to people in a certain way that's very, very helpful. But there's a point at which they're no longer useful, or we need to be able to take them off when they've outworn their usefulness. So I always get the image of a fireman at the end of the day just being able to take that coat off, like do something else. But these roles are very, very sticky. I know for me, one role that was very, very sticky when I was first invited to teach was simply the role of a student. I was so, the way that I conceived of myself was so wedded to being a student that to actually start to offer things as a teacher felt very disorienting for quite a while. And I had one really masterful teacher, because for me, the gulf between sitting there and looking up and receiving someone else's wisdom and sitting here and actually just offering whatever I could, that felt like a whole world to cross between that. And so I had one teacher say, okay, go down and sit there. Tell me what you see and tell me what you feel like. And then she said, okay, come sit up here. Now what does it feel like? How do you feel? Now go back there. And what do you see and what do you feel like? And now come back. And it was this going back and forth and slowly realizing it doesn't really matter. It doesn't say anything intrinsic about me or about who we are. It's just performing a different function. That's it. So that was quite a liberating process. But these roles get very sticky. You know, at some point, being able to let our children go. I've been having a lot of conversations with people about this lately. People come up to me and say, you think your separation is hard right now. I just said goodbye to my kids as they left home, as they went off to school, as they moved out and started their own family. Like, I had to let go of that. So how can we soften that, the view that's linked to that role when it's no longer needed? It's very, very difficult. So all of this requires creative experimentation with who we think we are. Definitely working with fear, but also being willing to play and experiment. Whenever we feel ourselves with this feeling of, I am this, this is it, this is me, I am this way, really noticing. So in this process of becoming more sensitive and gradually opening ourselves up to learning, we can see now, we can definitely feel, but they can prove and show that this actually changes the structure of our brain, which changes how we perceive information, which changes our sensitivity, which allows us to experiment and create more and have our sense of view become softer and more pliable. And it becomes now a positive reinforcement loop. But the actual structures of the brain are undergoing a change, so the world that we see is different. And this, for those of us who are inspired by such things, this is quite something. One of the things they found, going back to David Kish and looking at blindness, was that when they studied his brain, visual images were appearing. The images in his, areas of his brain that responded to visual stimuli were lighting up as they did in a person who was sighted. So even though he couldn't conventionally see, he was seeing in a sense. There were images showing up. So this is fascinating to me because it says a lot about the process of perception that we're not perceiving things that are out there and taking them in. We're creating the perception from the way that we're taking in information, the way that we're relating. We're creating the view and the perception ourselves. So the quote that I read at the beginning from Dzogchen Rinpoche, talking about a bit about this pliability of view and how the view begins to change. He says, one begins to appreciate the humor of the situation when we're not taking ourselves or our view quite as seriously. We can start to see the humor and the play in us. It can become less like the Easter egg hunt and more of this open exploration of our potential, really, of what we're capable of. So one thing I'd just like to say, just as a comment in closing, that I thought was interesting and relevant is last Thursday at the White House, maybe some of you heard this, there's a meeting of more than 100 Buddhist teachers from all different traditions who spent a whole day kind of in their own practice, but also dialoguing with policymakers. And there was a Washington Post article that talked about this. And one of the reflections that I thought was helpful was talking about various things, like the situation in Burma and various issues. But one of the things that one of the Zen teachers said in this article was that at first, for many people, meditation was treated as sort of an individual extreme sport. Other people went off helicopter skiing or mountain biking, and we would go to the monastery or the retreat center and sit and try to, you know, get to this enlightenment point, wherever that meant, whatever that meant. And it felt very individual. But as our understanding, especially in the West, as our understanding of it has deepened and as our maturity with practice has deepened, it becomes much more about not only our own individual practice, but how are we relating to each other, to our larger Sangha, to the world. And it just starts to widen even further. And it may be that the skills that we've been learning and what we've been developing are, we could make quite a contribution as a larger Sangha to some of the difficulties of the world right now. And so David Loy will be here tomorrow, and he'll speak a bit to this. He's a social activist and Zen teacher, and he's speaking on how Buddhism and the modern world need each other. And Steve Armstrong will come on June 5th and talk also about community, about the fabric of our community and what helps build harmonious relationships within community. So this is still another way that we can soften that self-view. Very, very helpful. So let's sit for a moment.